Thanks, John, and good morning, everyone. When I talk to investors about fixed income, the sort of the sense I often get is, you know, fixed income's got two sort of core characteristics. It's dull and it's complicated. Now, in fixed income, you know, we happen to think dull is not a bad thing, and I'm a sort of a virtuous representation of that. But we definitely think complicated is not good. You know, fixed income should not be complicated. And so what we'll do is we'll step through a bit of fixed income 101. I have to press the button, do I? Okay. Fixed income 101, to talk about what fixed income is and then how we think you should invest in it and how it fits into people's portfolios. So, you know, we think the starting point with any asset class is really to ask the question, what are you trying to achieve by taking this asset, taking this risk onto your books? If you don't know where you're trying to get to, it's very hard to map out how you get there. In terms of fixed income, what it is basically is very simple. You are lending money to somebody, and you're hoping at the end of a fixed period of time, you'll get your money back. It's as simple as that. You know, it doesn't get too much more complicated. There's a few nuances. Is the borrower going to pay you a fixed rate of interest? Is it fixed for the term you've lent it to him? Or will the rate of interest he pays you move with the markets over the time to maturity? You know, how long is the maturity? The longer in the future you get your money back, the less certainty there is in getting it back. So maturity is a key characteristic. You know, will you get your money back? How good is the borrower? You know, the return of capital is what it's all about. And, you know, finally, if you need money in the interim, you've lent money to somebody for 5 years, you need money in the interim, can you trade that loan that you've given? Can you trade the security? Is it liquid? So that's what a fixed income security is and should be. It shouldn't get too much more complicated. Why do we want them in our portfolios? Because of that certainty. You know precisely what you'll get over a defined period of time, and that makes them a much less volatile asset class than equities. They provide a regular known income stream, and they should preserve your capital. They shouldn't be complicated. The more complications you have in a fixed income security, the less those three core characteristics will survive periods of stress. And if you think about, you know, why you want such a dull asset class in your portfolio, the reason is simple. It actually adds value. The research we've done internally over a 30-year time horizon, if you hold 100% Aussie equities portfolio versus one that's got 30% fixed income in it, the rate of return, the annual rate of return over that period is about 30 basis points different. It's about 11.7% versus, I can't read this, it's actually less than that, sorry, it's about 11.8% versus 11.5% annualized over a 30-year time period, but the volatility is completely different. The annual volatility reduces from about 18% to 10%, much less volatile. The worst one-year performance shifts from minus 40% in a single year to minus 23%. And in a rolling three-year period, which is when investors really start to get narky, the worst cumulative three-year performance with 30% fixed income goes from negative 28% down to around negative 15%. So very little hurdle in terms of the opportunity cost. Huge difference in terms of portfolio performance. So we think, you know, it's an important thing to get right in your portfolios. So what happened over the last 2 years? I mean, those statistics only work if your fixed income actually behaves defensively, if it actually gives you your capital back, if it doesn't lose capital. We've seen a lot of product, a lot of risk over the last year. Last 2 years that have just seen equity-like downside returns. So you're getting a small coupon on the upside. We've had stress and we've seen products priced 50%, 60%, you know, some of them 100% loss of capital. So it's not that simple necessarily. So it's important that if you want to use the portfolio diversification benefits, you have something that actually behaves defensively in periods of crisis. So leading into the downturn, we saw investors basically being optimistic, not being terribly concerned about risk. Products were developed that worked and were based on a benign environment. So we saw lots of products that slowly captured a lot of embedded leverage in them, you know, the alphabet soup of CDOs and CLOs and all those kinds of things, but also a lot of funds gradually moved down the capital structure, and we saw a lot of funds with a lot of long-dated hybrid type risk. And that type of risk behaves in a very equity-like manner when things get tough. So we had a lot of underestimation of risk. Everyone knows that you know, eventually the music stops, but acting on that knowledge is really quite hard. And we all know that market timing is not an easy thing to get right. The reality of fixed income markets, with any market, is they are very volatile. This chart tracks the risk premium above a risk-free bond of the A-rated credit universe. So that's your BHPs of the world. How much do they have to pay above a bank bill or a government bond to get funding in the marketplace? And what really stands out to me there is that the fixed income market can be benign for very long periods of time. You know, it just lulls people into a false sense of security. Things are steady. You get your 50 or 100 basis points above bills for year after year after year. And then over a 1 or 2 year period, you get some stress and you lose the whole lot. And, you know, I thought that was the case before 2007 and 2008. You know, it certainly proved to be a greater truism than any of us expected. And, you know, it's interesting the dynamic through there. The market, on the back of the subprime crisis in the US, risk premiums really went through the roof. They sort of breached the long-term maximum we saw. And we get to this little jag here, and everyone thought things were good. Why is that? Because the Fed bailed out Bear Stearns. Okay, there's a line drawn in the sand. We all know where the future is. We're okay. That lasted a few months, and then we saw Lehman's fail. And, of course, that pulled the rug out under everyone's feet. You know, risk pricing just went haywire. And to put that line into some sort of context as to what it does to security values, if you own a 5-year BHP bond and you bought it at a spread of 100 and it's suddenly revalued at 500, it means you've lost a 5% premium for a 5-year time horizon, which is 25% of your capital. So this stuff, even for the best borrowers, can be really volatile. And that's where, you know, the risk lies, even in good credits. It's structuring portfolios. It's understanding how much volatility you're building into portfolios. So somebody said to me earlier, look, it's all come back. There's no opportunity there. It's too late. You know, the pricing as it sits is still way, way above any historical norm that we've seen. And, you know, for our funds, we're still buying secured, short-dated AAA securities at spreads of 200 to 500 basis points above bills. So the core portfolio that we run at this point in time is still throwing off spreads, you know, in this market environment of nearly 5% above the bill rate, so around about 8% per annum. So we still think that there's a very strong opportunity there. The critical thing is, you know, is the opportunity real? Are the assets going to pay back? And where are the risks? How do you use the opportunity to build a certain return into your portfolio? So how do you go about doing that? And look, you know, we're asked all the time, are you rethinking how you run risk? You know, has all of your theory and practice been undermined? And look, we've obviously taken lessons out of this. Some of the lessons just reinforce some of the basic ideas that we had in running portfolios. One of the key ones is the complexity is a bad thing. Complex securities rarely are easy to price, rarely easy to measure risk, very hard to get right. So, you know, we've certainly fine-tuned and we've added some metrics to our process, but the basic underlying things that we focus on are still true. Fixed income has got asymmetric risk return. The best you'll do is the guy pays the coupon and gives you your capital back at the end of it, i.e. there's really no upside. You know, the best you hope for is that you'll get what they told you you'd get. That's pretty unexciting stuff, dull. When it gets interesting is when they don't pay you back. So it's highly asymmetric. Little upside, lots of downside if you get it wrong. And we've seen lots of cases of that over the last year or two. So it's about risk management. It's focusing on the downside risk. What is the probability of default in a portfolio? You deal with that by buying good securities and by being highly diversified. So it's quality securities, transparent securities, and high level of diversification. And one of the discussion points that we often have in talking to investors is, you know, in a managed fund, that pull to par, the reality that you'll get your capital back after 3 years or 5 years or whatever it is less transparent than if you buy a hybrid in the marketplace. A hybrid's a simple instrument. People seem to live with the volatility because they can see the simplicity of it. The reality is it's just not diversified. Most hybrids are down the capital structure. They're the same names as you've got in your equity portfolio, so there's no diversification of name risk, and it's a really small universe. And just to give you some sense of that, I'll sort of do what passes for a party trick in the world of fixed income and just show you the universes that we're talking about. So in the world of hybrids, the entire Aussie universe is contained on this sort of half page here and this quarter page there. The names of the issuers are all ASX 200 companies, more or less. And, you know, the yellow bits, the majority of them are not rated. So they overlap with your equities risk. They're way down the capital structure. They're very poorly diversified. In a broadly based fixed income portfolio, you not only get that, you get the rest of the universe. And the rest of the universe, you know, a proper fixed income universe looks like this. So we've got, that's every security in the domestic universe. There's 25 sort of tightly packed pages of options to invest in. They're all in investment grade. They're all significant names. They're all liquid. So comparing the two universes is really, you know, looking to compare a fairly different experience. So we'd go for the 26.5 pages than the 1.5. So in our view, what went wrong was not a misunderstanding of the basic requirements to run proper fixed income risk and proper fixed income portfolios. It was just losing sight of that risk, being optimistic in terms of pricing, being optimistic in terms of default outlooks, being optimistic in terms of liquidity outcomes. And just as an example, I guess, of that, you know, everyone's become very cynical about ratings agencies. So this is just looking at what happens to ratings over a time period. So what is the likelihood of default for every ratings category measured by Standard & Poor's? And there's a couple of misconceptions. I mean, AAAs can and do default, you know, and they'll do it at any point through the economic cycle. They're most likely to do it in a down cycle, but defaults are an everyday part of life, even at the AAA level. So you cannot, with 100% confidence, avoid the risk of default in any fixed income risk. But what we do know is that as you move down the quality spectrum, as your rating becomes poorer, as you move down the capital structure within an issuer, the probabilities of default, the probability of risk, rises exponentially. And quite suddenly, too. Once you move out of that decent investment grade scale, the probability of loss becomes quite high. And that's accentuated by terms to maturity. So poorly rated, longer dated securities are much, much likely to default than a shorter dated quality portfolio. That's self-evident. Everyone knows that. One thing that's less self-evident is that, you know, to move down the spectrum, you want to be rewarded for that risk. And on all the metrics we've ever measured, you are always undercompensated as you take more risk. And so in our view, the sweet spot in terms of compensation for risk is in the investment grade sector, particularly if the fixed income part of your portfolio is meant to be defensive and stable. The other thing with ratings, they're very one-dimensional. All they're saying is this security has a certain probability of default over a certain time horizon. It says nothing about how liquid that security might be, how likely the rating is to be volatile through its life. And so, you know, we regard that as a very one-dimensional metric of risk, ignoring the fact that the ratings agencies really haven't done a particularly good job in measuring that risk over the last couple of years. So when we're perpetual look at risk, we try to drill down and look at all the different risks that that exist within within portfolios. So we think it's really important to look at risk on a portfolio basis and also look at all the different types of risk, not just default risk. It's to look at liquidity, it's to look at the volatility, it's to look at the structure. One of the key risks that is often put into portfolios is just maturity risk. So the longer you commit to a lender, the more you'll be paid, but the greater the risk you're taking. What people probably don't understand is just how that risk ramps up. So in an A-rated universe, the default probability on a three-year commitment is 31 basis points in a diversified universe. You go out to 5 years, it becomes around 70. You go to 10 years, it becomes 200, so 2% default probability. It ramps up very rapidly as you take term risk. Yet in portfolios, it's often treated quite innocuously. The other interesting thing about term risk or maturity is the reason we think fixed income makes sense in a portfolio is that it acts as a counterweight to equity volatility. Maturity has got a strong correlation with equity volatility. So for short maturity, fixed income has got a very, very low correlation with equities. As you take greater term risk, the correlation rises. So at 1 year, the correlation is about 15%. At 5 years, it's 45%. 10 years, 55%. Long-dated securities act quite like equities in down markets, and we've seen that, you know, in portfolios recently. So high quality, relatively short-dated, is starting to build defensiveness into portfolios. Rating, the same thing. Positioning on the capital structure, you know, we have the Australian hybrid market. A hybrid is just the sort of, in our view, the equity that you you don't get paid for, but you lose your money on if the company goes bust. To some extent, you're getting the worst of both worlds. If you look at recovery rates at the senior level, if a borrower defaults, you're likely to get between 60 and 70% of your capital back in a wind-up situation. You move into a subordinated position, you get about 28% back. If you move into the world of hybrids, the statistic is about 12%. So it makes a big difference where you're positioned on the capital structure. Industry sector, critical. You know, people are comfortable with banks. Banks in Australia have done well this cycle. In the UK, most of them have gone bust. We've only got to go back to the 1990s when we had a lot of major Australian banks go bust, things like State Bank of Victoria. You know, Westpac was close to the edge. So sectoral diversification is really important. In this recent downturn, you know, counterintuitively, the banks have fared the worst, and your bog standard corporate has actually done quite well through it. So, you know, the risks are multidimensional, and in our view, they compound. When you've got more than one of these features on a security, the risk doesn't double, it quadruples. So if you've got a long-dated, poorly rated, you know, finance company down the capital spectrum, you know, 10% of your portfolio, you really are asking for trouble. And if things go wrong, you know, you lose all your money. So our portfolios, you know, we assign a log scale of risk to all these characteristics for every security and in every portfolio. And just to give you a sample of how that flows through to portfolios. There was a recent retail issuance of Tabcorp. In our view, it actually wasn't a bad deal. It's a senior bond. It's not a hybrid. It may be listed, but it's actually a senior debt obligation, so it's quite good. It's reasonably rated, BBB+, 5-year term to maturity, and the pricing on that was 425 over bill, so not a bad spread. But if you factor in all of those risk factors that we looked at earlier, our risk score, which is just a metric, it doesn't mean anything in particular, was 1.84. In our portfolios, we prefer to own the institutional bond, which has only got 2.5 years to maturity, similar spread, a risk score of about 1/3 that. So again, buying into that institutional marketplace, properly pricing risk, you can buy similar returns at a much lower risk exposure. So that's the... Sorry? Yeah, but the simple fact is it's more likely to go belly up over a 5-year time horizon than over a 2-year time horizon. You can make a better judgment about what's likely to come across Tabcorp's bows over the next 2 years than over the next 5 years. That's why we've used that example, because everything else is the same. Well, the institution would have better liquidity, but you can only buy that in licks of $500,000. There is no acquisition cost. These are over the counter instruments. There's no brokerage. There's no fees. You just buy them at a yield. And look, this is one example. I guess one of the points is that, in a granular listed space, you've got, barely, I don't know what that number is, but not many securities available to you. In the domestic institutional space, we've got 25 pages of the stuff. You look globally and there's, a multiple of 100 times that. So they're different markets and different dynamics. Of course, yeah. So that's, the only variable there is just term to maturity. Everything else is the same. But having said that, we can be more confident on our view in Tabcorp for the next 2 years than we can over 5 years. And I think there's been lots of instances where that's been demonstrated of late. Look, it's on that scoring basis, that's correct, yeah. And it's a metric that, we believe works. It's just more likely to happen. It's less likely to happen in 2.5 years than 5. Yeah. So every day, it's just a simple probabilities game. And if you're being paid the same margin, why take the additional risk? So the risk score is merely—it's just a metric. It's a way of trying to compare. It's not magical. It's not a rating. It's just simply a relative comparison. It works best when you've got multiple risks. So how do you compare a Tabcorp or another recent example? AMP Capital did a Tier 2 subordinated debt issue recently. How does that compare in a risk sense and a value sense to some senior AMP paper that trades not that far away from that? And the answer is, that's where it really starts to look very different. That's just a simple illustration to give you some sense of how small differences can make a big impact on risk. So that's sort of looking at the credit dynamics. The other core dynamic in fixed income portfolios is duration risk. So are you taking exposure to floating rates or fixed rates? In our view, through time, that actually has got the biggest impact on your performance. It is the most volatile aspect of a fixed income portfolio. People sometimes, I think, get a bit bamboozled by it, but really the analogy is simply, do you fix or leave your housing loan floating? You know, if rates are going to fall, you hang on to a floating rate housing loan. If you think they're going to rise, you fix your rate. If you're an investor, you do the opposite. If you think rates on the balance of probability might rise, you don't want to lock in your return. You leave your rate floating. And so over the last year or so, a year ago, the yield curve in Australia was this red line. It was flat. It was inverse, in fact. It was quite high. 9 months later, it's moved down to there. So, you know, in the 3.5 year term where the bond index sits, it moved from around 7 to around about 3.5%. And, of course, that meant bond portfolios outperformed dramatically as they were marked to market. So bonds had a really good 12 months. The reality, of course, is that rates probably have bottomed. In any event, they can't go through the zero axis. So on the balance of risk, they're more likely to rise than fall, in our view. We've seen that already. We've seen bond portfolios underperform as a consequence. You know, the question, I think, for investors is, how much fixed rate risk do you want to take in this environment? You know, we think in a balanced portfolio there's room for it. But if you're doing an analysis on the balance of risk, you probably want to benefit as rates rise, not be penalised. And therefore, a floating rate portfolio on the balance of risk is probably the place to be. And a good example of that is the last big down cycle that we had on the back of financials collapsing and property collapse was in the early 90s. And in 94, when rates started to tighten again, holders of government bond portfolios lost, I think, somewhere in the order of 12 to 15% of capital. So even government bonds are subject to lots of risk if, you know, you've got a lot of duration exposure. Okay, now that brings us into, you know, how we think you should start to lock this asset class into your portfolios. Obviously, the important consideration is, you know, what the clients need. And at the end of the day, that's a decision for the advisor, not for us. What we look to do is to try and form some judgment as to, you know, where in the duration spectrum we want to be. I mean, do we think that over the immediate future, rates are likely to rise or fall? And how do we take risk there? Do we want a bond fund or a bank bill indexed fund? And secondly, credit risk. Is credit risk, is the additional return you're getting for taking exposure to non-government issuers, which is what credit, you know, is lending money to BHP paying its way at this point in the cycle. So we take those two key metrics of risk or its spread and overlay that with a view on markets to decide where value lies. And so that, you know, they're the critical things on a client side. How much liquidity do you need? What's the investment time horizon? If it's longer than the term to maturity of your portfolio, you see no volatility over time. And how much volatility on the way through can the client take? That determines whether you hold cash or some sort of risk instrument. The risk instrument you hold depends on your view of interest rates, depends on your view of risk premiums and the direction of risk premiums. And just diagrammatically, you know, that's how the universe looks. It's pretty simple. If rates are rising, you want to have floating rate investments so that your investments with rates. If rates are going to fall, you take a fixed rate view because you lock in that rate. So that's your duration decision. Pretty simple stuff. Likewise with credit risk. Do you buy BHP or do you hold a bank bill? Well, if BHP is paying you 20, maybe not BHP in the 5 years. But if it's paying 400 or 500, as it was a few months ago, maybe that's a good bet. Obviously, the longer you take those positions, the bigger the volatility becomes. Holding a term deposit for 90 days is going to be a lot less than taking a 10-year government bond on the interest rate side. And likewise, holding a 1-year BHP bond is going to give you less volatility than a 10-year BHP bond. So I think a lot of people get confused about the impact of duration versus the impact of credit spreads. It's pretty straightforward and totally separate. And just a simple definitional thing, the fixed rate universe tends to be government bonds. It tends to be a bond universe. The floating rate universe typically is much more diverse. The largest component in Australia is residential mortgages, so RMBS securitisations, which are, in our view, very robust and particularly at the moment very cheap, but not exposed to interest rates. Okay, so just drilling down a little bit further into that credit risk decision, you know, in our view, the first decision is setting your duration. Do you want to be in a floating rate environment or a fixed rate environment? And then secondly, where on that risk curve do you want to be for credit risk? Do you want to be at the sovereign end of the market or at the high yield or hybrid end of the space? In our view and on our metrics, the investment grade space gives you the best risk return. It makes fixed income behave like a defensive asset, and it offers that diversification benefit in a balanced portfolio. Close to the end now. If you accept that thesis, at this point in time, in the balance of risk, you know, if rates are more likely to rise than to fall, and you do look at a floating rate universe, this is the sort of metric that you're facing at this point in time in the market. So the red bottom part of that graphic is what you're getting returned in your portfolio from the basic bank bill interest rate. And you saw, you know, as Glenn Stevens was tightening up to head off the explosion in the economy in 07, you know, you saw an increasing return from the floating rate universe. But the risk premium from credit spreads, which is the section above it, was very, very poor. And so your incentive to hold risk should have been very, very low. I mean, investor behaviour was that typically they didn't act on that. They actually levered up that little spread to try and make it bigger, which was the wrong thing to do in hindsight. The dynamic that you see in a downturn is that interest rates are usually forced downwards. You know, as the central bank tries to stabilise the economy, and the perception of risk rises, so the spreads rapidly widen. And so you've got a situation at the moment, and this is A-rated credit, we're talking about BHP again, or that type of stock, where the premium we're getting for holding their name as opposed to a bank bill is actually higher than the interest rate. So the spread on that chart, and 400 basis points, and the bank bill rate's about 320. So the return for risk at this point in time of the cycle, we think, is extremely strong. You know, we're starting to see a lot of transparency. We know which companies are going to survive, which companies are going to fail. We're starting to see the equity markets opening up to recapitalise companies. And so in our view, this is a once-in-a-cycle opportunity in terms of pricing for credit risk premiums. We'd assert to do that, you know, you should be in that investment grade space. You should be in relatively vanilla securities, and you should access the full universe that's available to you. If you try and do that as a retail investor, you know, our view is that you probably do need 100 securities to be properly diversified. To buy those directly at $500,000 each, you need to be a $50 million fixed income client. Not too many of those around. So the dynamic for this sector lends itself to pooled investments. You know, we believe that strongly. The other dynamic is that the market is global. These securities trade globally. In periods of stress, there's often a strong hometown bias. So the spreads available on, for example, a Bank of Queensland, one-year senior bond domestically might have been 150 basis points. You know, we were buying those bonds in New York at 300 or 400 basis points, just simply because there's less comfort with foreign names in periods of stress. So again, you know, being part of a professionally managed pool, you get access to a broader opportunity set. You are more diverse. You know, you're not exposed to that very narrow risk base within hybrids, and you get a lot more opportunity to trade relative value. The last few months, we've been generating the bank bill proportion of our return just trading securities rather than just sitting and collecting coupons. And then finally, that risk management aspect is what makes a portfolio like that behave in downturns. It keeps your capital values intact. And that's certainly what we've seen within our funds over the last 2 years. So just to wrap up, you know, in our view, fixed income is defensive. It should behave well during a downturn. It should be stable. And the way you achieve that is really to focus on high-quality securities, really focus on getting value for the risk that you're taking, be diversified, and be in a position to really actively manage those risks. And if you do that, you do get high predictability in your returns. You preserve your capital, you get your income stream, and you've got liquidity if you need it. We've certainly seen that over the last couple of years, but we've seen a lot of strategies where that has failed, and the returns you've got from fixed income directed assets have been really very poor. So it is an asset category that does potentially, if it's well managed, give you very strong predictable returns, particularly right now. If it's poorly managed, you just get all of the downside that equity can generate. So that's the end of my talk. I'll hand over to Ian. Okay. Picking interest rates is really hard. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that make a lot of confident assertions, but if you look at the statistics, the amount of people that actually get it right is limited. The information ratio in punting interest rates is low. It's a tough game. It works probably at extremes. So 2 years ago when rates were really, really high and you had a lot of black clouds on the horizons, you know, being long duration was probably a fairly safe bet. Same as 6 months ago when the world was going to end. You know, they can't go through zero, so at some point in time they'll turn around. At the extremes, I think it's in an investment sense, you can make those decisions a bit more easily. The problem is that once you're away from those extremes, it becomes more problematic. You know, at the moment, there's two dynamics that we can see, or three really. The economy is still really weak, and we think the potential, we're not predicting it, but there is a potential that it stays weak. And so that bounce back and the tightening of rates doesn't happen. The second is that governments have got to fund all of the stuff that's happened in the last 2 years. And the amount of paper that's going to be issued into fixed income markets is going to push rates higher, all things being equal. And, you know, the third one, obviously, is that if the economy does start to pick up, you will get tightening. We're not in the business of trying to predict that. We're just trying to balance the possible range of risks and try to optimise what happens, you know, within that range of risks. Our view is that, on balance, we probably have bottomed. Rates probably will begin to creep up. In that sense, you're better not to buy the long assets, particularly because there's a lot of them going to be printed.
Reading between those lines, your portfolio is shorter duration than the benchmark.
That's the basic bent, yeah. Yep, okay. I mean, that's a good question because I think that's kind of, you know, a lot of investors seem to be happy with those because they're very easy to understand, even though in our view they're quite risky. Risk really is a function of the quality of your obligor. So if you lend money to me, it's 100% safe. If it's to John over there, it's dodgy. So it's taking a view on your obligor. So that's the same across any structure. And so fundamentally, you know, if you don't think you're going to get your money back, then there's no upside in fixed income. All they're offering is to give you money back. So, you know, if you take a risk on somebody who's less likely to do it, you're not really getting a lot of compensation. Yeah. That's right. And so the other variable is, when do they give it back to you? And the longer the time horizon, the more difficult that becomes. And so perpetual securities, which is not to say securities issued by Perpetual, but things that never pay you back, are a great value when they're selling at 25 cents on the dollar. And, you know, we were able to buy recently perpetual, very long-dated T1 instruments issued by major banks as low as 16 cents on the dollar. Now, at that price, it's not bad. At 100 cents on the dollar, or as we saw not long ago for things like NAB income securities, 105 cents on the dollar, maybe not so good. So to some extent, if the obligor is good, it comes down to a pricing decision, and also how much volatility you're prepared to live with. Well, it's made it a lot better for banks trying to access the market. So, I mean, the government has guaranteed issuance by banks. The primary reason for that is that there was a point in time where nobody trusted anyone, and so even the best banks couldn't issue paper. So that threatened that would have collapsed the financial system. To begin with, those government guaranteed bonds were issued really quite widely. So, you know, even people like CBA were issuing government guaranteed bonds at swap plus 130. So, you know, that's miles wide of where a government bond trades. And they were very, very cheap. That market, as risk has sort of come out of the universe, that market's normalised. Banks are starting to access the market without guarantees. So I'm not sure that it's done a whole lot to spreads, except to do as it was intended, which is to stop the whole thing falling over. And, you know, that really massive peak that we saw was pricing in just the system collapsing. The government guarantees have taken that risk out of it, and we've already seen that unwind. It makes no part in the decision making in the sense that the portfolio is all marked to market every day, so it all flows through. It's not optional as to whether some mark more than others, and I think that's a really good point, because at the end of the day, the asset class should be transparent. It should be liquid. You know, through this cycle, it hasn't been. People have defended that either by locking up so you couldn't get your money out, or just optimistically marking or putting huge spreads on their products. You know, our view is that these assets should be liquid. When portfolio managers talk about poor liquidity, they're normally talking about the fact that the bid they're getting they don't like. They're talking about price. No, because the fund is properly marked. And, you know, we're confident that we can sell any security we own at the price it's marked. And so the knowledge flows through to the investor. The issue then becomes, you know, do you want a lot of volatility? We'd assert that you don't in this asset class. And so we manage to avoid it. And so we're not afraid of proper transparent pricing, because we think the portfolios withstand that volatility. Yeah. Look, I think what's been highlighted is that it's a cyclical sector like any other, and, you know, the more risk you take, the more volatile it's going to be. And so I think I'm not sure that it necessarily leads to a change in products or outcomes. It's more that people, it's going to be a lot more transparent. you know, you can't pretend you're buying a fixed income asset and have a portfolio full of 10-year T1 deeply subordinated global bank paper, because if things go wrong, you'll lose 60% of your money. So I think people have been educated. I think they will do more due diligence. They won't be scared of the alphabet soup that exists in this asset class sometimes. And I think people will also be more prepared to say, look, I don't want risk, therefore I shouldn't expect too much return. I'm happy to just take a nice, sensible, simple rate of return and be able to sleep very confidently. So I think, you know, there was a lot of smokes and mirrors that induced people to take risks they weren't aware of, and even the portfolio managers were probably not even aware of. So I think it just has really opened up, let a lot of sunlight into the space, and I think the space will benefit. We think it's really cheap. We're seeing really good flows into our funds because, you know, they've held their capital values really well, and it's really cheap. So I think if you know what you're doing, it's good. Look, ratings agencies try and do a good job. They're commercial agencies. They get paid for doing ratings. So there's a bit of a commercial conflict there. In our view, they do a good job in looking at primary risk. So they can assess Westpac or they can assess BHP and do a reasonably good job on it. And we think that's continued to be the case. Where they've fallen down is where they've tried to be clever, because in fixed income, being clever is not a virtue. And again, I'm a living example of that. If you start to compound risks within fixed income securities, the risk rises exponentially. And so we had the ratings agency saying, look, a subprime pool of mortgages, which is pretty crappy, if you've got enough subordination, if somebody else is losing money first, if there's enough of that, we can rate that AAA, because not all of those borrowers are going to default. And that's been the case. Even in subprime US, if you're holding a senior AAA bond, most of your money comes back to you. Well, because that's right. Because that's my next point, okay? What NAB bought is not that stuff. What they then did is, on those pool of crappy assets, somebody else was taking first loss. Now, that's maybe not so bad, so we'll call that BBB. Okay? But that's only a 1% or 2% slice towards the risky end of that portfolio. And what the smart investment bankers did is they bought a whole bunch of that first loss BBB risk, put that into another pool called a CDO, and the ratings agency says, well, you know, not all of it's going to go bust, so we'll call that AAA. And that's where NAB got stuck. That's where the ratings agencies got stuck, because the correlation, the likelihood of it happening may be low, but the consequence if it happens is really bad. Nah. Well, look, you know, they got onto the merry-go-round. You get paid per rating, and so that's an incentive, yeah. And I think, you know, they've done themselves immense harm. You know, we have a AAA-rated CMT, you know, which invests in the most low-risk securities on the face of the planet, and the AAA rating almost became a handicap, you know. If it's AAA-rated, it must be bad. And so that sort of is something that they will take years to overcome. And it comes back to my little Pentagon-y thing. When you compound risks, they're really hard to measure. The ratings agency thought not only they could measure them, but they could get to the point where they could assign AAA ratings to really, really complex, convoluted, levered structures. And that won't happen again.